go on to case number 2, which is 083833, Suzanne Brin versus Michael Astrew. And it's Mr. Whitley. Come on up, Mr. Whitley.
Good morning. My name is Jason Whitley. I represent the claimant, appellant Suzanne Brin. May it please the court, counsel. This, thankfully, is not a typical Social Security appeal, given the fact that the file was lost and attempts were made to locate it for over 3 years. But I think that the fact that the file is lost is not the key turning point in this case, but rather the merits of the decision-making process. I'd like to talk first about the activities of daily living.
Before you get started on that, I guess there was an aspect of this case that seemed to me important to the ALJ's approach to it, which is the fact that we're looking at a fairly short time window for assessing her disability. Because we can't start it until after the earlier phase is over, and then it has to shut down at her date last insured. So are these daily activities something that would focus on that time frame?
They would be, because these are daily activities that she testified at the hearing during the time frame that the administrative law judge provided, the September of 07 through December of 98.
Right.
Separately from that, there is the lost activities of daily living, which would have been done on two occasions, one when the initial application was made and another when the request for reconsideration was filed. So that evidence is no longer with us, and we don't know specifically what that said.
What is your best medical evidence that she was disabled?
The best medical evidence predates and postdates the particular period of time that we're talking about. But there's no indication during this period of time that she had a spontaneous recovery, and in fact all the testimony and the medical evidence indicates that her disability stayed at least the same or deteriorated and became more severe. So the best medical evidence is simply the rheumatologist Dr. Butwinick's report and his RFC from 1996, and then his follow-up report in April of 2001. With regard to the specific activities of daily living, and I think these are very important because the lack of medical treatment during this very narrow period of time that the judge was talking about, Sue Brin testified about what she did and how this fibromyalgia affected her. In the administrative law judge's decision, she talked about the fact that there are these activities of daily living which are not in any way related to what the testimony was. The administrative law judge at page 10 of her decision indicates that Sue Brin wakes up in the morning, gets her children off to school, makes breakfast, then picks up around the house, throws in some laundry, does grocery shopping, and these types of things. Oh, prepares supper for the family and washes dishes. In the record itself, and the way the administrative law judge characterizes this is so far removed from what the actual evidence was. In the record, Ms. Brin testifies that she gets up with her husband and they try and get the kids off to school. He dresses them. She makes breakfast, or if she's unable to, they eat breakfast at school. Then after they leave, she picks up, if she can, around the house, if she's able to, and then she lays down for a morning break or a morning nap. She's testified that she does laundry once in a while by throwing in a load of clothes after the children bring the laundry to the laundry area, and then her husband and the children fold the laundry. She says she does no vacuuming, no cleaning, and when her husband had a heart attack, the son actually moved home to take care of household chores for this 5-month period. She goes shopping with a friend or with her family, and if it's necessary, she'll go by herself. And what she does is she has a wagon in the driveway, which she puts the groceries in and pulls the wagon up to the house to get the groceries into the home. This is her testimony of what her life was like during this year and several month period that the administrative law judge focused on. Yet when the administrative law judge characterizes this evidence, it completely minimizes what was actually going on and says she does the laundry, she gets the kids off to school, she does the dishes, and...
But, I mean, that, even if you're right and that the administrative law judge has somewhat overstated the daily activities, they are just one of a number of reasons that the judge gives to support the conclusion that she's not disabled from this condition. You know, the page before the one you were referring to goes through quite a few things. She doesn't see the doctor very often. She's her objective medical evidence about the right knee. I mean, on and on. I mean, so the administrative law judge is looking at the whole picture, and I don't think the administrative law judge or anybody else thinks that she's the picture of health. I mean, I'm sure she's not. I mean, but that's not the standard.
The administrative law judge says, I look at the objective medical findings and the ME report. She gives great weight to the medical examiner. The objective medical findings are crystal clear. All of the trigger points for fibromyalgia are present. That's a diagnosis that carries with it certain symptoms. And she, instead of placing great weight on Dr. Butwinick's report and restrictions, she says, I will place great weight on the medical examiner's opinion because of several reasons, one of which is there was no notation by him that he saw loss of strength as a diagnosis in the record. Quite the contrary, there was. In May of 1995, there's a clear indication that she had loss of strength in both arms. So she's giving great weight to the medical examiner, who has never actually examined Ms. Brin, and who also himself misstates what the medical evidence was during the time of the diagnosis.
But this is the case, too, in which there's some cloud on one of the reports that Dr. Budwinick provides. I'm looking at the paragraph about the November 25, 1996 report, no treatment notes, and then there was some, the ALJ says, further the record reveals that Dr. Budwinick was paid for the report, and there's this comment, obviously the more restrictions you place upon Mrs. Brin because of her condition, the better her chances of obtaining Social Security disability will be. I think the ALJ is a little uncomfortable with this report.
I think that notation, that report is of particular significance, or the way that it came about is of particular significance, is much overstated. Ms. Brin has to have a report from a medical provider. There's only two ways to get it. I can call up the doctor and say, Doctor, we need a report. I need you to take your time. We'll obviously pay you. And, by the way, get a pen out, and could you say this? The other way to get a report is to write a letter to the doctor, which I did, and say, would you please prepare a report? We'll obviously pay you for your time. Keep in mind, this is important for her, and the more restrictions you place on her, the better her chances of being found eligible for Social Security. But that letter was not hidden. It was disclosed immediately. The judge asked for a copy after the file was lost, and I produced it immediately. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing untoward about the process. You have to get an opinion in some fashion.
Did Dr. Butwinick actually diagnose her with depression, or did he merely note that she admitted to feeling depressed?
He, I think, noted that she feels depressed. The quote is, admitted feeling depressed. So there was no workup for depression, admittedly, but depression is, among all the other symptoms of diagnosis with fibromyalgia. So the fact that she has these symptoms that go along with a concrete, objective diagnosis doesn't mean that the symptoms aren't there because they haven't been individually worked up. I think there's sufficient support in jurisprudence that fibromyalgia is a illness which has unconfirmable types of symptomology once you have these positive trigger point findings, which incidentally she had all of them.
But the record isn't going to provide for us any basis for his opinion as to the depression and as to the minor cognitive impairment.
Well, I see that I'm out of time. Other than the record with regard to all of the symptoms that she has is objectively noted by the finding of fibromyalgia. So that is an objective finding. The subjective symptomology that goes with fibromyalgia is something that cannot be objectively ascertained through MRIs or these other issues.
Okay. Morning, Mr. Duarte.
Morning, Your Honor. Alan Duarte on behalf of Social Security Administration. Counsel. May it please the courts. The ALJ's decision in this case should be affirmed because it was supported by substantial evidence. Before I address the ALJ's treatment of the evidence, and in particular her reasonable evaluation of the treating physician's opinions and plaintiff's credibility, I would like to comment on two arguments that plaintiff has raised in the brief, one of which is factually unsupported and the other which is legally unfounded. Plaintiff argued that in his brief that the ALJ had barred him from presenting evidence at the hearing, and a simple review of the transcript shows that that is simply not true. Plaintiff also argued in his brief, his main brief and his reply, that he was entitled to benefits based upon the alleged obduracy of the agency in processing his claims. And this court has made clear in Briscoe that that argument is contrary to controlling law and that obduracy is not a grounds on which to award benefits.
Well, that may be true, but I am a little concerned about the fact with the careless treatment of this record, which I'm sure everybody regrets, but the new hearing doesn't seem to have really started from scratch. The ALJ says that she's giving great weight to the opinions of these psychological consultants from the old record because it's consistent with the overall evidence of record, but of course it's not really in this record, and the only thing we can really review is a record. And so I'm concerned when she tells us she's giving it great weight, how can we then delete it from the finding and be confident we know how she would have come out?
Well, Your Honor is correct. There was a reference in the area of the mental impairment evaluation that referenced the prior opinions of the state agency physicians, which, as you indicated, was not in the record. However, given the way that the evidence came in on the mental impairment, that is a not a reversible error, because this is not a situation where the ALJ was balancing the evidence from the state agency psychiatrists against some competing evidence from other mental health experts. What she was dealing with was the fact that there was an absence of evidence that plaintiff has produced with respect to mental impairment.
Well, but I had the very same question that Judge Wood had. When you have an ALJ stating that she gave great weight to the opinion of the medical consultants from the prior proceeding, why isn't that alone a reason to remand this?
Your Honor, because you can remove that from the calculus and it doesn't change the ALJ's reasonable evaluation of the mental impairment, because this is a situation where she didn't need to rely on that. There simply was no evidence that was brought forward of a mental impairment.
Well, except in the sense that Mr. Whitley was arguing, which is not as an independent illness but as a valid symptom of the fibromyalgia, the kind of depression that was being described was there. If she had said, oh, and I note in passing that these old psychological consultants had a certain opinion, but we don't need to worry about that here, anything like that. But when she tells us she's giving it great weight, why Why isn't that inconsistent with the finding of what you're essentially arguing for, which is harmless error?
I think that plaintiff's argument gets to the crux of the issue here, which is that a diagnosis of fibromyalgia by itself is not sufficient. The ALJ we can have a lay understanding that depression may be a symptom of fibromyalgia, but the fact is the regulations require that there be some clinical evidence showing that she has depression and to indicate what the degree of it is, and that simply didn't exist here.
But why doesn't it show something about the severity of the fibromyalgia? I mean, I take another argument you're making is, you know, on a scale of 1 to 100, where 100 is the worst, some people have fibromyalgia at a 30 and some people have it at an 85 and so on. So it's maybe only the people at the more severe end who are going to be disabled. But this evidence might tell us which end of that spectrum she falls on.
Well, Your Honor, there is very little evidence here in that regard. All we have are a couple of references from Dr. Butwinnick. And really what it is to plaintiff's, her own lay use of the term depression, that she says she felt depressed. He did not take any steps to follow up on this, which I think is indicative in and of itself of how he viewed this allegation. He did not send her to a mental health specialist. He did not do anything. He did not make any notations to indicate any independent corroboration of any even visible symptoms. And I understand, and I think the ALJ did, the nature of fibromyalgia, but there are symptoms that can be clinically corroborated, and certainly there are psychiatrists and psychologists who diagnose depression all the time. This doctor's rheumatologist did not even notice that, for example, she was had a flat affect or appeared with disheveled clothing or anything like that. In fact, all he did, and going back to his original records, is in 1995 he saw her once. He made a diagnosis of fibromyalgia, very simply, found nothing else unremarkable about it. The next time he saw her was 7 months later in 1996, and he described her as remaining moderately symptomatic. So as Your Honor indicated, the evidence here is not of a severe case of fibromyalgia. It is simply a situation where the medical evidence and the other evidence did not show that plaintiff had fibromyalgia of a disabling character, and it was
You're
a plaintiff.
You're not contesting, though, that she had a valid diagnosis of fibromyalgia.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Dr. Butwinnick was a rheumatologist, and he saw her and treated her, and he made a diagnosis of fibromyalgia. And the ALJ recognized that, found that it was a severe impairment, and limited the plaintiff to light work. And she did adopt some of Dr. Butwinnick's restrictions. She found that his restrictions on the use of limbs was supported by the evidence, and she accepted that. But she went on to explain that she did not accept the other aspects of his opinion because they were not well supported and they were contradicted by the other evidence. She did rely upon the ME. Counsel has indicated that all she did was rely upon the ME, and that is not borne out by the analysis in the decision. But the ME was present. He was an expert in physical medicine. He reviewed the evidence, and he did offer an opinion that the ALJ took into consideration, as she should have. In addition, she also evaluated the plaintiff's credibility. Counsel has indicated that she overstated the activities of daily living, and that was not a sufficient basis on which to render her decision. But the ALJ is required to analyze plaintiff's allegations and her activities of daily living in evaluating her credibility, and that's what she did here.
Well, it's one thing to analyze, I guess. I thought Mr. Whitley was saying that the ALJ wasn't really sticking as carefully as she should have to the real descriptions of what was going on. It wasn't like she was popping out of bed at 6 in the morning and racing around the house and doing a million things. She was doing what she did only with the assistance of other family members.
Well, Your Honor, the ALJ did not go into detail about plaintiff's testimony and what she did, but she did accurately describe her testimony about what she could do and what she did around the house. And again, that is it was in the context of her allegations that really set apart those activities of daily living and show that they were inconsistent with what she was claiming she suffered from. She said she was in constant pain, that she hurt all over her body, that she could not stand or walk for more than a few minutes, that she sometimes could not tolerate being touched. And I think the point the ALJ was making is that given those allegations, the fact that she's doing these things shows that that's simply not, that they're incommensurable. And in fact, she even pointed out that Dr. Butwinnick's restrictions were not consistent with what plaintiff was saying she could do. Certainly Dr. Butwinnick did not limit her to walking or standing for only a few minutes. Your Honor, we've already discussed the mental impairment issue. Unless you have any more questions, I will rest on the brief on that and simply ask that you affirm the ALJ's decision and deny plaintiff's appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Duarte. Mr. Whitley, you used up all of your time, but I will give you 1 minute.
The particular thing that I want to talk about real quickly is the difference in opinion between the ME and Dr. Butwinick. When the administrative law judge looked at the ME report, she gave great weight to that report, but his opinion was based on a misunderstanding of the background evidence from the May 5th, 1995 diagnosis of loss of arm strength. On the other hand, Dr. Butwinick is the treating physician. He gives a report that reduces her down to below light work, sedentary work. There's nothing in his RFC that's inherently inconsistent with the record as a whole. The ALJ keeps saying there are inconsistencies with the record as a whole, but there aren't any pointing. There isn't any actual inconsistency that is discussed or pointed to. Her testimony about activities of daily living are consistent with Dr. Butwinick's restrictions and also with his report from 96 and again in 2001.
Thanks to both of you, and the case will be taken under advisement. We'll go on to